indigenous lands back into indigenous hands. And these are demands to both of these administrations, because this entire democracy is built on the stolen lands of indigenous people. So this is what we're calling for at this time in history. You know, unprecedented levels of investment into indigenous languages, the return of indigenous lands back into indigenous hands, and a ceasefire.
Nick Tilson, I want to thank you so much for being with us, founder and CEO of the Indigenous-led NDN Collective, a member of the Oglala Lakota Nation. He's speaking to us at a conference from Raleigh, North Carolina. And tune in on election night to Democracy Now!, Tuesday, November 5th, for a four-hour election special, War, Peace, and the Presidency. Join us from 8 p.m. to midnight Eastern Time. We'll also be airing an expanded two-hour election show on Wednesday, November 6th, from 8 to 10 Eastern Time in the morning. Any station, radio or television, can take these broadcasts as well. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for our video news production and digital fellowship programs. You can learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Gutzer, Sheriff of Dokuduce, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Teresena, Tammy Warnoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astugio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, and Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Hi, this is Cecil Prescott. Celeste Carey and I are the co-hosts for More Talk Radio, which airs on KBOO FM 90.7 on Mondays at 8 a.m. For 30 years, Celeste and I have been encouraging and engaging interviews and conversations about politics, social issues, and things which concerns you, your family, and your community. Join us on Mondays at 8 a.m. and be a part of this community radio experience.
Tune in to KBOO on October 31st for two thrilling Halloween marathons. We've got a great lineup of nine different DJs spinning their favorite haunting tracks. Get the eerie vibe started early with part one of our spooky marathon, Hallow's Dawn, from midnight to 7 a.m. And as the sun sets, don't miss part two of our chilling soundtrack, Hallow's Twilight, from 7 p.m. to midnight. That's KBOO's part two marathon, Hallow's Dawn and Hallow's Twilight, from 12 to 7 and 7 to 12 on your favorite spooky station, KBOO. Check out our other upcoming Halloween specials and seasonal merch at kboo.fm/Halloween.
Support for KBOO comes from KBOO members and Grendel's Coffee Shop, located at East Burnside and 8th Avenue in Portland, featuring coffee, tea, sandwiches, and more. Information at grendelspdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, two ballot boxes were set on fire in Portland and Vancouver.
OHSU delays its nomination of a new president.
And the Washington Post won't endorse a president for the first time in 36 years. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, October 28th, 2024. I'm Ron Bronson.
And I'm Eliza Yurkov. Fires at two ballot drop boxes in Oregon and Southwest Washington have destroyed some voters' ballots. Last night, a suspect in a black Volvo attached an incendiary device, or a type of bomb, on the side of a ballot drop box in Multnomah County, located on the 1000 block of Southeast Morrison. Only three of the ballots in the box were damaged, thanks to a fire suppression device, which each ballot drop box in the county has. The voters' ballots who were impacted were already notified and given replacement ballots. Investigators think it's connected to another incident last night in Clark County, Washington. There, hundreds of Vancouver ballots were burned. The county auditor says their fire suppression system didn't work nearly as well, and they don't know who might have been impacted. They're encouraging voters to drop off their ballots before 5:30 p.m. Any voters who dropped off their Clark County ballot in the box at 3510 Southeast 164th Avenue over the weekend are encouraged to contact the county election office. The phone number is 564-397-2345. The FBI is investigating both of the incidents. Police say the attempts made last night could be related to a similar attempt to burn a ballot box in Vancouver on October 8th. Multnomah County Elections Director Tim Scott said in a press release, quote, "We have multiple systems and security measures in place to ensure your ballot is safe. Your elections team is making sure that every vote counts," end quote. Anyone with information related to the case is encouraged to call the Fire Department Investigation Tip Line at 503-823-3473.
Oregon Health and Sciences University is delaying its resolution to name Dr. Nate Selden as president to replace Dr. Danny Jacobs. Jacobs announced his retirement last week in the midst of an alleged case of photovoyeurism. He said in an email on Thursday, quote, "After consideration and for personal reasons, I've informed Board Chair Chad Paulson of my intent to resign as president, effective the appointment of a successor," end quote. Dr. Daniel Marks was accused of taking upskirt photos during a classes he taught. Marks received a $46,000 bonus just before his dismissal under the dean, Dr. David Jacoby, and President Jacobs. President Jacobs and his senior staff claimed that Jacoby solely authorized the payment and did not take action after a student complained swiftly enough. Jacoby, who was demoted earlier this year, filed a lawsuit against OHSU last week for defamation and unfairly pinning all the blame on him. Dr. Nate Selden became the interim dean of OHSU's medical school in February when Jacoby was demoted. The board of directors named Selden as the replacement president instead of doing a national search because of his tenure at the school and connections to the community. Governor Tina Kotek expressed concerns over the quick timeline to appoint a new president because it would, quote, "compromise the future of the institution and that it would be a mistake to push through this decision of magnitude without appropriate due diligence." Jacobs collected extra retirement pay in June while hundreds of employees were laid off due to financial struggles at the university. Members and leaders of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Local 328, a union that expressed support for the OHSU Legacy Health merger, have been critical of the university's management this year. They packed a board meeting on Friday and played bingo with squares for buzzwords including, quote, "difficult choices," "we hear you," and "it's not in the budget."
The Washington Post and the LA Times announced they refused to endorse a presidential candidate just 11 days before the November 5th election. Both newspapers are almost 150 years old and have rich histories reporting on American politics and the U.S. government. The Post has oscillated its endorsements of both Democratic and Republican candidates. It did not regularly make presidential endorsements until 1976 and only endorsed Democratic presidential candidates except in 1988 when it declined to endorse either George H.W. Bush or Michael Dukakis. The LA Times only endorsed Republican presidential candidates for almost 100 years before taking an endorsement hiatus from 1976 to 2004. For the last four election cycles, the Times endorsed Democratic presidential candidates. Both newspapers have experienced declines in readership and advertising revenue in the last decade. Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon and one of the richest people in the world, bought the Post in 2013 for $250 million. Patrick Soon-Shiong, a billionaire biotech investor, bought The Times in 2018 for $500 million. Both newspapers' editorial boards were preparing to endorse Vice President Kamala Harris. Newspaper endorsements are traditionally the prerogative of the publisher or the owner. In January, Bezos brought in the current Post CEO Will Lewis, a former consultant to conservative Boris Johnson when he was a UK prime minister. Colleagues told NPR that Bezos chose Lewis as a way to get along with powerful conservative figures. Soon-Shiong's daughter expressed interest in the newspaper and sought to influence its coverage. She announced on X that the decision to not endorse either candidate was specifically to protest Harris's support of Israel. A spokesperson for Patrick Soon-Shiong said his daughter's statements aren't true at all. Multiple staff and subscribers for both newspapers resigned and ended their subscriptions in protest of the decision.
A course at the University of Washington called How to Steal an Election looks at the United States election weaknesses. Eric Tegadoff has more on this story.
A timely course at the University of Washington explores the vulnerabilities of U.S. elections. The course is called How to Steal an Election, although political science professor James Long, who is teaching the class, notes the subtitle is a warning, not a how-to guide. Long believes Americans may have overlooked the vulnerabilities in the country's elections until 2016, when misinformation and Russian interference campaigns exposed weaknesses in voting systems.
While that is all true, it's also true that a lot of other countries have faced these issues, and the U.S. has faced these issues historically. And so the class is really about trying to remind Americans that we're not always alone in the world, and we're not always alone in the issues that we face.
Long says the name of the course was inspired by a book called How to Rig an Election, which is about election fraud around the world, and the so-called Stop the Steal movement after the 2020 election, which led Trump supporters to storm the U.S. Capitol building to try and stop Congress from counting Electoral College votes. Long says the 2020 election has hopefully proved to be a lesson for Americans. However, he notes that this year the U.S. could be in for a destabilizing period between Election Day and Inauguration Day, especially as threats have ramped up against election workers, legislators, and judges.
The intimidation and the violence that has been targeted previously and has been threatened against them in the future, that is a real worry of mine. And so I think it's incumbent upon everybody to sort of relax and not to let that anxiety lead to violence and things like that.
However, Long notes that while 2020 may have been a low point, he's noticed less cynicism from students about the 2024 election. He hopes there's been a course correction in the way people feel about the democratic process.
Where I start with the classes, the reason we talk about stealing an election is we have to talk about why they're worth stealing. The reason they're worth stealing is that democracy is a good thing. And democracy is not always perfect. It's rarely perfect. And it's not always a good thing for all people at the same level. But it's better than any alternative.
Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegadoff.
A new survey finds majorities in six swing states support a path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants over and above mass deportation. Eric Galatis has more on the story.
A strong majority of voters across party lines want lawmakers to create a path to citizenship for America's 11 million undocumented immigrants, not mass deportation, according to a new survey. Jennifer Piper with the American Friends Service Committee points to a series of so-called Show Your Papers laws passed in Colorado between 2006 and 2013, which led to some of the highest deportation numbers in the nation.
Here in Colorado, we already know what the policies of mass deportation look like intimately, and what we found is our businesses suffered, our schools suffered, our kids suffered.
Voters surveyed said allowing law-abiding undocumented residents living in the U.S. for years paying their taxes to apply for citizenship is a better way forward than a deportation program that would tap local law enforcement, the National Guard, and possibly the military at a cost of over $100 billion. To counter a barrage of anti-immigrant messaging and disinformation that has become part of mainstream conversations, the AFSC has launched a billboard and radio ad campaign in Colorado and five other states aiming to welcome all people to the U.S.
We really wanted to share a message that would remind us that Colorado is stronger because we value every single person's hard work and contribution.
Each year, immigrants add $54 billion to Colorado's economy, and Piper says people deserve the same rights as commercial goods and capital to move safely across borders. She points to the Registry Act as one solution, which has been gaining co-sponsors in both the U.S. House and Senate.
Which would allow people who are undocumented, who are neighbors, who've been here a long time, to come forward and get on a path to citizenship. It just requires the changing of one date in existing immigration law.
Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. This is Eric Galatis for the Colorado News Connection.
Former First Lady Michelle Obama campaigns about a loss of reproductive freedom in a second Trump presidency. Senator Lindsey Graham pushes back on John Kelly's fascist description of Trump. And advocates call for nonpartisan support for national parks. With these stories and more, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
The devastating consequences of teen pregnancy won't just be borne by young girls, but also by the young men who are the fathers. They too will have their dreams of going to college. Their entire future is totally upended by an unwanted pregnancy.
Speaking in Michigan, former First Lady Michelle Obama says for men to live better lives, women have to be treated as more than baby-making vessels. Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump face an electorate deeply divided by gender, in part because of reproductive rights issues. Senator Lindsey Graham is lashing out at remarks by Trump's former chief of staff, John Kelly. The former Marine general says his former boss praised Adolf Hitler and fits the definition of a fascist. South Carolina Republican tells ABC it's an attack that won't stick.
He's entitled to his opinion. I just categorically reject it. 3 weeks before the election, you're calling basically Trump Hitler a fascist. It's not going to resonate.
Vice presidential nominee J.D. Vance once texted a friend that Trump could be America's Hitler. Former Republican Congresswoman and Harris supporter Liz Cheney says Vance is now going through unbelievable contortions to defend the former president.
Donald Trump, J.D. Vance, they absolutely understand how damaging it is for the American people to see all of these unprecedented levels of senior officials from the Trump administration telling the American people that Donald Trump is unfit.
A new University of Maryland poll in six swing states finds strong bipartisan majorities want a path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants, not mass deportation. Jennifer Piper with the American Friends Service Committee says a series of so-called show your papers laws in Colorado led to high levels of deportation, which closed a huge number of businesses and split up families.
Here in Colorado, we already know what the policies of mass deportation look like intimately. And what we found is our businesses suffered, our schools suffered, our kids suffered.
Rosa Alicia Clemente was the 2008 vice presidential candidate for the Green Party. She recently appeared on Yes Presents, Rising Up with Sonali, and pushed back on the idea that third-party candidates are election spoilers.
We're never spoilers. You know, more and more people want to be part of a third party. So I think we also have to take that opportunity after the election to actually build a third party.
By comparison, America's public lands are extremely popular. Kristen Brangle with the National Parks Conservation Association says polling consistently shows opposition to cutting their funding.
But this is why it's so important to hold members of Congress accountable and to have their constituents see what grade they got and push them in the next Congress to do better and to be more pro-park.
I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, it's our last episode of Running on Air. Tonight's weather is mostly cloudy with a few showers, getting down to 47 degrees. Tomorrow's weather is drier, mostly cloudy, with a high of 56 degrees. Today in history, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner became the first elected female president of Argentina in 2007. Isabel Perón was technically the first female president, but was not elected to office. She served in place of Juan Perón, her husband, who died in the middle of his term. The quote of the day is from the 1959 parasitic horror film, The Tingler. Dr. Warren Chapin explains how the creature operates and could even infect you. Quote, "The tingler exists in every human being we now know. Look at that tingler, Dave. It's an ugly and dangerous thing. Ugly because it's the creation of man's fear. Dangerous because a frightened man is dangerous."
Native people across the country are responding to President Joe Biden's formal apology for federal Indian boarding school policies, and the Harris-Walz campaign held a rally at the Navajo Nation over the weekend. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez for National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Native people across the country are responding to President Joe Biden's formal apology Friday for federal Indian boarding school policies.
I formally apologize as President of the United States of America for what we did.
KUNC's Emma Vandenhuyde has reaction from Colorado.
Tribal Chairman Manuel Hart from the Ute Mountain Ute Tribe in Colorado says it's a great starting point, but he thinks one of the main steps toward healing is revitalizing the native languages.
The extermination didn't work, but the assimilation that they did through these boarding schools to take away the language, it affected 3/4 of the tribal nations across this country. So that's why it's so important to bring it back.
Hart says he and other tribal leaders have already taken some of their own actions, like getting a charter school on their reservation and working on a Ute Mountain Ute dictionary. He dreams of having a junior college and a trade school, but he says that's only possible with additional funding and more action at the federal level. For National Native News, I'm Emma Vandenhainde.
In South Dakota, a Native group wants to see action, not just an apology. South Dakota Public Broadcasting CJ Keene has more.
In an emotional, teary, and challenging discussion, Rapid City-based Indigenous Advocacy Network Indian Collective hosted a press conference in response to the president's apology. However, the tone of that response was definitive.
I'm sorry, it doesn't work for me. It just won't.
That's the voice of 78-year-old Daryl Nohart, a survivor of the Indian boarding school system. It's a sentiment reflected throughout the press conference. Indian Collective CEO Nick Tilson says apologies without meaningful change mean little.
You have demands to the President of the United States and to the Department of Interior at this moment in history.
Those demands include an audit of still active schools that trace their roots to the boarding school era, the revocation of Medals of Honor for participants in the Wounded Knee Massacre, and executive clemency for Indigenous activist Leonard Peltier. A boarding school survivor, Amy Sazu, with Remembering the Children, says there is yet more work to do.
While this is an important and historic first step, it is just that. And I will anxiously await the next steps.
For National Native News, I'm CJ Keene in Rapid City.
Meanwhile, the Harris Walls campaign held an event on the Navajo Nation. Dignitaries included Navajo Nation President Boo Nigrin, former Navajo Presidents Joe Shirley and Jonathan Nez, Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, and U.S. Arizona Senator Mark Kelly. Harris's running mate, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, delivered remarks. KGLP's Rachel Cobb reports.
Themed as an early vote celebration, Window Rock's October 26th event ended with Harris running mate Walz repeating talking points from the Democratic platform, honoring late Navajo code talker John Kinsel Sr., listing how Kamala Harris and the Biden administration have served Native people, such as lowering insulin costs, the economy, including providing funding to Native communities, and addressing missing and murdered Indigenous persons. Then noting how important the Native vote is.
If the Navajo Nation turns out the numbers that we know you can and do, it won't just be Arizona that goes. It is entirely possible, and I think probable, that we win the whole damn thing.
This is Rachel Cobb.
The Navajo Times reports the Trump campaign held a webinar with Navajo Republicans supporting Donald Trump for president, while the rally for Harris Walz took place on the Navajo Nation. Trump supporters include former Navajo Nation Vice President Myron Leiser. Leiser reportedly campaigned for Trump along with a group of people in Window Rock as the Harris Walz event was taking place. They held signs and flags along roads during the vice presidential candidate's visit to the reservation. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Idaho utility companies are struggling to transition to clean energy. An annual report that grades utilities on their clean energy commitments finds they haven't improved much in recent years. The report gave Idaho Power a C and Pacific Corp a B. Eric Tegedoff reports.
A new report grades utilities based on their commitment to transitioning away from fossil fuels. The Sierra Club has graded utilities on their climate pledges since 2021 in its Dirty Truth report. It finds marginal improvements nationwide, with utilities only committed to retiring 30% of their coal generation by 2030. Director of the Idaho chapter of the Sierra Club, Lisa Young, says one troubling trend is that some utilities claiming to clean up their power generation are simply switching from coal to natural gas.
Knowing that our ultimate goal and what we need to be doing to address the climate crisis is not replacing one fossil fuel with another, but replacing fossil fuels with 100% clean renewable energy.
The report graded two utilities in Idaho, giving Idaho Power a C grade and PacifiCorp a B grade. While it operates in fewer parts of Idaho, PacifiCorp serves a large swath of the West, including parts of California, Oregon, Utah, Washington, and Wyoming. Idaho Power and PacifiCorp own a coal-fired power plant in Wyoming, with PacifiCorp in control of 2/3 of the plant. Young says the utilities plan to convert the plant to gas power, which would have had some slight benefits in the long run. But PacifiCorp changed its mind this year and said it would continue using coal, deciding to install carbon capture technology instead.
That's why Idaho Power gets a bad score in this report, because PacifiCorp, the co-owner, is making these poor decisions about continuing to burn coal past 2030. And it's impacting Idaho Power and all of us as the customers and everyone in the region.
Young says Idaho Power should push PacifiCorp away from coal.
Even though it's not the majority owner and this other utility, PacifiCorp, has most of the final say in what's going to happen with that coal plant, Idaho Power does have an opportunity here and a point of leverage to really try to shut that coal plant down and to stop burning coal at that plant.
She also notes that Idaho Power should not put any barriers in the way of rooftop solar so that households can also be part of the renewable energy change. For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Seaweed farming in California has enormous potential to help mitigate climate change, but faces significant challenges, according to industry figures. Suzanne Potter shares details on the story.
The seaweed farming industry is in its infancy in California and has huge potential, but struggles to overcome obstacles in funding and permitting. Right now, the state only has two commercial seaweed farms. Tori Polizzi runs Sunken Seaweed in Humboldt and says the costs to start up operations and get regulatory approval are very high.
And that's where 99.9% of the companies hit a wall in this industry in California. You're looking at permit costs, and this isn't like guaranteed permits. It's maybe you'll get a permit. Low end, 100K, high end, million.
Seaweed and other marine plants store carbon. The company, Ocean Rainforest, has an 86-acre project off the coast of Santa Barbara. It's still in the research phase, but the goal is to fight climate change at scale by growing 1 million tons a year by 2030. Ronald Tardif is Ocean Innovation Lead at the World Economic Forum. He urges the U.S. government to fund more startups or risk being left behind.
The EU has spent probably at this point hundreds of millions of euros on R&D related to seaweed in a way that the U.S. has not.
Stephen Hermans founded Phyconomy, a database that tracks the seaweed economy. He says private investment in seaweed ventures has dropped from a peak of about $100 million in 2022 to just $8 million for 2024 so far.
Now we are in the valley of disappointment after the peak of the hype, and now we have to make it work. The USA investors have become a little bit more sophisticated, and they're asking better questions, and that will ultimately lead to better investments.
In the future, seaweed companies aim to replace petroleum feedstocks to supply the animal feed, fertilizer, and cosmetic industries. This story was produced with original reporting from Alexandra Talty, Pulitzer Fellow for Civil Eats. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Scientists say climate change is intensifying wildfires, especially in the panhandle of West Texas. The region is addressing the problem with the ancient technique of prescribed burns. Frieda Ross has more on the story.
90% of the state's wildfires occur in West Texas and the Panhandle. Climate scientists warn that the wildfire season in the state will likely grow longer and more intense because of higher temperatures and long dry spells. Archie Stone is the wildland coordinator for the Borger Fire Department and says weather patterns influence the number of fires the state will have.
A lot has to do with that setup as far as out in the oceans go and how our weather patterns set up. Some winters are warmer and drier. Some winters we start seeing the moisture and they're pretty docile.
In an effort to control and fight the fires, the Borger Fire Chief hired Archer to set prescribed burns across the region. Prescribed burning is an ancient technique that's still practiced by some Native Americans, but it isn't widely used across the U.S. Stone says the process gets rid of grass and brush that could fuel a wildfire. He feels it was instrumental in containing wildfires earlier this year.
The Windy Deuce fire, between it and the Smokehouse Creek fire, you know, we burned over 1 million acres. And in particular, southwest of Borger, we have a lot of open pasture. There's a historic ranch out there, and they allowed us to put a 250-foot black line. And when that Windy Deuce fire came towards border, it actually hit our black line and it went out.
He says the temperature, humidity, and wind speed must be perfect before they set ablaze. The prescribed burns need to be repeated every 3 to 5 years. This story was produced with original reporting from Keaton Peters with Inside Climate News. I'm Frieda Ross, Texas News Service.
You have been listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, October 28th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team tonight is Eliza Yurkoff and Althea Billings. The producer for this broadcast is Eliza Yurkoff, and our engineer, the incomparable Althea Billings. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Eric Alatis, Frieda Ross, Alex Gonzalez, and Eric Tegadoff. The director of the Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News on KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath at 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM. I'm Ron Bronson.
And I'm Eliza Yurkov. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our illustrious, outstanding members. If you would like to become an illustrious and outstanding member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
From the Coast Range Association, this is Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gaskill. We are on the brink of an irreversible climate disaster. This is a global emergency beyond any doubt. Much of the very